Morning, friends. This is the third of four sessions on the material and spiritual worlds. In the first session, we discussed the Baha'i concept of the two worlds, material and spiritual. Spiritual, the world of values. Material, the world perceptible by the senses. And one of the points made was that we human beings live in those two worlds simultaneously, and that any actions we take are actions which are of consequence in both worlds. This led us into the second session yesterday, which dealt with an exploration of what the Baha'i teachings say about how we can attract spiritual powers to us from the spiritual world, which enable us to reinforce our activities constructively in this realm of existence. And that led us into the intriguing concept expounded by Abdu'l-Bahá, the so-called magnetic principle, using magnetism as an analogy for the arrangement of actions or attitudes in a manner which conforms to the law of nature or the divine law, and which therefore attracts or has associated with it what we call magnetism, and that is used as an analogy for the attraction of the spiritual powers. That then led us into a discussion of the various categories of spirit which are manifested in the world today, the mineral, vegetable, animal, human spirit, and then of course the spirit of faith, all as deriving from the power of the Holy Spirit. Today we want to take it a step further by introducing the dimension of time. This has been absent thus far. Yesterday when we talked about the magnetic principle, it was basically a snapshot, taking a picture at one point, the point being of the individual who carries out certain activities which attract spiritual power. For example, prayer. The individual says prayers, and those prayers, although it appears a trivial action in the material sense, are of great significance in attracting spiritual powers. The act of having faith, the act of teaching the cause of God, and the like. These are snapshots taken at a moment in time which indicate how we attract the spiritual powers. But today, when we incorporate the dimension of time, we find, somewhat regrettably, if you will, that things become a little more complicated. Not terribly so, but enough to make it interesting. Before we go further in this, I might mention that my understanding of the writings is that when we proceed from here to the next world, when we die, in other words, we go to a realm which, as the writings say, Abdu'l-Bahá says, the kingdom of heaven is not a material place. It is sanctified from time and place. In other words, we have the dimensions of space and time as part of this realm of existence, but in the next world, if you will, it is, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, it is a spiritual world without the dimensions of space and time. Abdu'l-Bahá goes on to say, to be limited to place is a property of bodies and not of spirits. He says further, place and time surround the body, not the mind and spirit. So it is beyond those dimensions. This immediately gives us the corollary that we cannot comprehend the next world. We can speak of it in terms of values and attitudes and things that are good, bad, or indifferent, but we cannot visualize what it is because we are unable to visualize anything that is outside the dimensions of space and time. We can deal with it or manipulate it mathematically, as one does in certain mathematical theories, but as far as conceiving it in our imagination or our visualization, that is not possible to us. What we know is that while we're in this realm of existence, we mark the passage of time in two ways. I'm using particular terms here. One is to describe the passage of time as being marked through recurrent or circular events. The sun comes up this morning, and it's whatever day it is, I've lost track of the days, but let's assume it's Wednesday. Is that a reasonable statement? It's Wednesday. Okay, the sun comes up tomorrow, and lo and behold, it's Thursday. Recurrent events used as a mark of time. And there are a number of recurrent events to which we are exposed in this realm of creation. We also mark time by linear events as well as circular events. Circular events are what I described, the sun coming and going. Linear events are those that are irreversible. A baby proceeds to childhood. A child proceeds to become a youth, to become an adult, who becomes an elderly person. These are irreversible consequences of the presence of time. So in this very sort of simple-minded approach, we see time, to which we are exposed in this realm of creation, as having two characteristics, recurrent or circular, and linear or irreversible. I mention this because both these elements occur in the Baha'i teachings. In the Baha'i teachings, we find recurrent practices as well as linear or irreversible practices. And so we need to consider both types of event in examining the Baha'i teachings, particularly in relation to our spiritual development. Let us focus largely on the recurrent events or the circular events because they are the source of our growth and development. We know, of course, very, very well that the world in which we live is full of all kinds of recurrent circular events. The transit of the sun across the sky, lunar cycles, the effect of the motion of the moon on the tides, the passage of seasons, movement in a subatomic realm, the subatomic movement of electrons and around the nucleus, and the movement of various atoms in a larger structure. In astrophysics, we have things like Halley's Comet that turns up every so often as a cyclic event by which people in the past would measure that passage of time. The fact that certain times of the year there are meteor showers, we can predict those as coming at a certain time of the year. It is a recurrent event. The rotation of the Milky Way around the center of the galaxy is a recurrent event, what's it, every 25,000 years, more or less. And then, of course, astronomers have found most recently that the entire galaxy has a rotation to it with a cycle, and that galaxy is part of a cluster called a supergalaxy, in which there is movement of the various galactic elements. And if that's not bad enough, the whole supergalaxy is part of a larger system of clusters of supergalaxies, by which time our resolution power of telescopes runs out, and we know the universe is beyond our ability to discern it through present-day optical or electromagnetic techniques. We know that human physiology has its circular events, the process of breathing in and breathing out, a circular events, the heartbeat, the so-called circadian rhythms of the fluctuations of secretions and endocrine systems and the like over the period of a day or over a lunar cycle or beyond, seasonal effects, so on. Sufficient to say that we in this realm of existence are immersed in a world of circular or recurrent events. It is therefore not unusual to find in the structure of the Baha'i writings and the Baha'i teachings the existence of circular events and circular or recurrent religious practices enjoined upon us. And one might well summarize these various circular events of our religious life as being those that put us into synchronism with the world in which we find ourselves, synchronizing with the sense of cyclical or circular or recurrent activities which are part of our existence in this realm. For example, daily obligatory prayer, the recitation of the holy writings at least once a day, the recitation of the greatest name to which we are enjoined in the Kitab-i Aqdas, the fact that our teachings tell us to bring ourselves to account each day is another circular event. That each day we bring ourselves to account, review our progress, and make plans for the future, another circular activity, part of the recurrent practices of our religion. And of course, all kinds of other things. We can go on at great length, the 19-day feast, the observance of holy days and tertiary days, the fast, Baha'i elections, and community activities. It's interesting that in devising the core activities of the five-year plan, one element of those are intensive growth programs, and the structure that has been found most appropriate is a recurrent one. Recurrence or circular events occur in the form of the intensive programs of growth. They have their various phases, and these phases then repeat in a cyclic manner. And so there again, there is a synchronism with the larger forces of society by virtue of our indulging, if you will, in recurrent events as part of our religious practice. And of course, at a much larger level, Baha'i activities of international conferences and going on pilgrimage at least once a year or once in one's lifetime, if circumstances allow, are all part of the rhythm of recurrent events in Baha'i life. Baha'i philosophy has the same sense of recurrence. If you look in the Kitab-i Iqan, the references to return and resurrection are of a cyclic nature. The concept of progressive revelation has inbuilt into it the sense of return and resurrection of a cyclic nature. And in the larger scale of vast lengths of time, our writings speak of universal cycles, the cycle of the dispensations making up the prophetic cycle of many thousands of years, and into the future, the anticipated sequence of dispensations making up the cycle of fulfillment. All of that leads us directly into what I want to talk about this morning, and that is our application of the magnetic principle in recurrent practices. In other words, what I'm saying is we have the magnetic principle that Abdu'l-Bahá set out, which we discussed yesterday. Now we want to put it into practice, and we need to put it into practice not just one shot as a snapshot taken at one point in our lifetimes. We want to put it into practice on a recurrent basis. For example, one of the points in the magnetic principle was that of prayer. And basically it says that if we make an effort to recite a prayer, that will attract a measure of the Holy Spirit. Well, we want to do more than just say a prayer as a one shot at one time in our lives. We want to say it on a recurrent basis. And it is that issue that we wish to discuss this morning. What are the factors involved in practicing on a recurrent basis those things which are described by Abdu'l-Bahá as sources of magnetic power or spiritual power, using the magnetic analogy? What we find, in my, and of course the whole thing is just my understanding, what we find is that when we want to put the magnetic principle into practice on a recurrent basis, we need to draw on three important principles. We need to add these three principles to our existing understanding so that we can practice these recurrent cycles in an appropriate manner. I want to mention those three principles and to discuss them in a little detail. There are three principles which seem broadly applicable throughout the entire range of Baha'i teachings. And they're not particularly complicated, but they're very significant. The first is set out again by Abdu'l-Bahá, although it appears intrinsically in the writings of Baha'u'lláh himself. And it's a simple principle where Abdu'l-Bahá says, and it's quite a simple statement, but one has to be very careful of simple statements in the Baha'i writings because they're deceptive. Lots of things are said very, very simply and very straightforwardly, and you're inclined to say, oh yeah, okay, that's right, that makes sense, what's next? And you stop and think about it, and whoops, he's really said a lot in that one statement. This is one of those. Abdu'l-Bahá says, change is a necessary quality and an essential attribute of this world and of time and place. Change is a necessary quality and essential attribute of this world and of time and place. Things change, like it or not. There is no standing still. If you're not going forward, you're going backwards. Things are changing. Things will change. It is a necessary quality and essential attribute. You can't sit back and say, it's time for a breather, let me rest for a while, and then later, when I'm feeling a little more like it, I'll pick up this whole spiritual thing of spiritual development and the like. Doesn't work that way. Change is a necessary quality, an essential attribute of this world. Our religion is a religion of change, like it or not. You might say, oh, I like it, I like the idea of change. Life's not boring if there's change. But also, change means that unfamiliar things turn up down the road, and one has to adjust to things that are unfamiliar, things that are novel, things that one hasn't been done before. In 1996, the House of Justice adopted certain views, certain expressions, which have given rise to the activities of advancing the process of entry by troops, which we're engaged in now until the year 2021. And this involved things we were not otherwise familiar with, the so-called core activities of the social activities of the faith. It is a reasonably radical change, and a number of people had trouble adjusting to it. They weren't used to it. Why can't we keep doing it the same way as before, and the like? But change is a necessary quality, an essential attribute of the world. And of course, the Universal House of Justice, as the head of the faith, is intrinsically and by its very terms of reference an agent of change. Change is built in to the terms of reference of the House of Justice. It is charged to effect change. One of its central roles is that to build the world order of Baha'u'llah that involves change. And the House of Justice functions include creating new institutions as necessary. Some years ago, I occupied myself with the thought of considering the golden age of the cause of Baha'u'llah. You know, we have the heroic age and or apostolic age and the formative age, and then ultimately the world order of Baha'u'llah will be established. We'll move into the golden age of the cause in this dispensation. And it'll be a very wonderful time of peace and harmony and very meaningful human relations. And it's described in many places in the writings. And the issue that I raised with myself was, clearly the golden age will be a wonderful time. And we'll agree on that by definition. But I said to myself, won't the golden age of the cause be unutterably boring? Won't it be a time of being terribly boring, of sitting around eating grapes and relaxing in the sun or anything like that? How is it that the golden age will be other than a period of very pleasant existence, but without any particular challenge to it, without any particular difficulty? Every day is a lovely day like every other day. It's a bit like kind of Queensland, you know. And then, sorry about that. I take that back. What is it that'll make it interesting? Because life, to be interesting, has to be more than just one pleasant day after the other. And eventually I answered my own question by reading a message of the Guardian called Unfoldment of World Civilization in the book World Order of Baha'u'llah. And in that book, the Guardian describes some of the characteristics of what people will be doing during the Golden Age, in the very last part of that message. And lo and behold, the Golden Age of the cause of Baha'u'llah will intrinsically be a time of change. Change is integral to the Golden Age. It indicated to me that to the ideal human condition is one of creativity, of change and growth. And Shoghi Effendi sets out in that message in some detail how that change will occur, what challenges there will be to the development of human society during the Golden Age, what the tasks will be which it will be called upon to accomplish, the issues that will be before it, and it's clear when you go through that list that it's subject to change. This occurs very, very broadly. The ideal human, the human state is one of change rather than static. So that's the first of three principles which I think are applicable in applying this magnetic principle. The second one is even more crucial, and that is the writings state, as far as I understand it, that this religion differs from the conventional expression of most religions around the place in that it places its primary value on effort rather than achievement. This is in contrast to the world around us. The world around us necessarily places its primary emphasis upon skill of achievement rather than effort. Let us say your taps are leaking in your house and you decide you want to get a plumber. You can either choose a plumber who's very, very skillful, who has a high level of achievement, or you can choose a plumber who makes terrific effort, who's willing to try very, very hard to solve the leaking pipe problem. Well, no contest. Let's get the skillful plumber, the one who's willing to make a great effort. He can go practice on some other poor soul, but not on us. And so it is throughout the world in which we live, our emphasis is on achievement, not effort. I spent a fair part of my working life at a university, and one would assess students and give them grades based upon their level of achievement. They would pass or fail exams, not on the basis of their effort, although effort was, you know, sort of taken into account, but not the primary consideration. We live in a world which places quite necessarily its primary emphasis on achievement rather than effort. And it seems to me that in the Baha'i teachings, it's t'other way round. For example, Shoghi Effendi says through his secretary, the very act of striving to serve, however unworthy one might feel, attracts the blessings of God, enables one to become more fitted for the task. And another similar passage, the harder you strive to attain your goal, the greater will be the confirmation of Baha'u'llah, the more certain you can feel to attain success. I find this most significant, that the Guardian says, the harder you strive, the greater will be the confirmation. In other words, the more effort you make, the more you will attract the spiritual powers. It's, in a mathematical sense, almost proportional to the effort rather than to the level of spiritual accomplishment. This is radically different. It's entirely different to the way we've been brought up unconsciously in this society. Our religion seems to me to put principal emphasis in value upon effort rather than achievement, and that is very central to the application of the magnetic principle. That it'll depend in operating the magnetic principle to get to attract the spiritual powers, we will attract them proportional to the effort we make rather than to our level of spiritual development. This has incredibly widespread ramifications. For a start, it means we cannot judge each other spiritually. We cannot judge or assess how much effort another person is making. You and I presumably are not alcoholics. There may be some here in this audience who are, and that's their private business. It's not our business. But let us assume that most of us are not alcoholics or never have been involved in alcohol to any significant extent. To us, it is no effort to avoid drinking alcohol. Take somebody who comes from a heavy alcoholic background. He or she will make a great effort to avoid taking a drink every now and then. Sometimes they'll succeed, sometimes they'll fail. You and I cannot possibly imagine the degree of effort required for that person to break loose from their habit of drinking alcohol. We cannot assess the effort required of any other person, even in something that seems very obvious and very straightforward. Therefore, we cannot judge each other, and therefore the House of Justice, in its message on universal participation around 1966 or 67 or whatever, it says that we should, as a community, constantly encourage each other, that our relationships are those of encouragement rather than those of handing out gold stars and silver stars for accomplishment. It is rather the recognition that encouragement supports effort rather than achievement. Another implication is that no human being is too far gone to attract spiritual powers. That might sound like a very strange thing to you. It's not intended to be. I've spent a good length of my life involved in the administrative order and in carrying out various functions. I've come across a number of very well-meaning, fine Baha'is who have come from a background where they feel themselves to be worthless for whatever has happened to their lives or whatever they've been through. They feel that God must not value them, and that therefore what is the use of striving to develop spiritually? This may sound a very strange line of thinking to you. It's not intended to be. There are individuals around the place who feel, when they think about things they have done which are quite contrary to the Baha'i teachings, they didn't know what the teachings were anyhow, but and as a result they feel themselves worthless. They feel themselves as removed from the love of God. And to such people, obviously it's a private matter, so you don't get involved in it, but if people come to you and talk about it, then one can say to them that this principle is one of putting value on effort rather than achievement. And a consequence of that is that nobody is too far gone. You can be a hitman for the mafia or something like that and have done all kinds of terrible things and left a pile of smashed up kneecaps behind you or anything like that, and you're not too far gone to attract the love of God and the prospect of spiritual development. So it is a message of reassurance to people who feel themselves as coming from backgrounds that are extreme in degradation. The other side of the coin is you're not in such great shape that you don't need to keep making an effort. Can't sit back and say, "Hey, I made it. You peasants should keep working, but I'm gonna but I've already got there. I've become this very spiritually developed individual, so I can relax and I don't have to read the writings every day, or I don't have to focus on the prayers or all this kind of stuff. You guys keep working at it. You got a long way to go. I've made it." Because that violates this principle. This principle is that of placing emphasis upon effort rather than achievement. The consequence is nobody's in such great shape that they don't need to make an effort. The Guardian refers to us to this phenomenon in certain places where he describes how sometimes an individual will serve the faith in a very distinguished way and carry out heroic or sacrificial services, and next thing you know, they've burnt out, they've gone cold. And in some instances, it may cause many different reasons, but one reason may well be the fact that they've reached a point where they decided that they were in pretty good shape, and so they became sanctimonious or superior, or conveying by body language their sense of superiority to the hoi polloi around them. So it's a very important principle, but it places emphasis upon effort rather than achievement. There were three things I wanted to mention as three principles applicable to the application of the magnetic principle. The first is the concept of change as being a necessary condition as part of human life. Secondly, the emphasis in the Baha'i Faith being on effort rather than achievement. And the third one is this, that we are told in the writings that, and it's, well, there's still part of the second one, that it is important in such a process to make a beginning. This is kind of obvious. The model we have at the moment, we're going to mess it up in a moment, but the model we have at the moment is of the individual making an effort, attracting spiritual powers and being reinforced by them. The consequence of that is that one should make a beginning and then the system will build up. All you have to do is make a beginning. Abdu'l-Bahá's famous statement in 1912, when he laid the foundation stone for the Baha'i House of Worship in Wilmette in Illinois, he said, "You have only to begin, everything will be all right." And that applies generally to our spiritual practices. The simple model that I'm going to ruin in a moment is this. You make a start and make a teeny bit of effort. Why a teeny bit? Because that's all you're capable of. That attracts a little bit of spiritual power and makes you stronger. Lo and behold, by coming stronger, you're able to make somewhat bigger effort, not quite so teeny. That bigger effort attracts a greater measure of the Holy Spirit, and so therefore you become even stronger. Now you're in a position to make quite a substantial effort. By a greater effort you're making, you're attracting an even greater measure of spiritual power, and you become a whole lot stronger. That then leads you to make an even greater, I mean, it gets boring after all, okay? You get to these shaggy dog stories. And so it goes on. It's what we call a positive feedback cycle. The effort you make draws spiritual blessings that make you able to make an even greater effort, which attracts an even greater measure of spiritual blessings, which makes an even further effort, and you become stronger and stronger. In other words, intrinsically, the process of spiritual development is one of drawing on this feedback relationship between effort and the spiritual powers attracted. And that's why Abdu'l-Bahá says, just make a start. Just get on the moving escalator and the thing will keep growing and growing and growing. And so much in Baha'i practice involves calling upon the individual to make a start, to make an effort, and things will come good. And that applies in Baha'i community activity as well as individual activity. Now, we have a problem before us. The problem is that there's something wrong with what I said. Because what I've said is a basic feedback relationship. Effort attracting spiritual powers, making you stronger, making greater effort, greater measure of spiritual power, etc., etc. Ad nausea, ad infinitum, I guess nausea as well, but ad infinitum, going on forever. The problem is that if that were true, we would all be highly refined spiritual beings already, all floating up around the ceiling. And I hate to tell you, but we're not. If what I have said is all there is, we would just make a start, things would grow, this positive feedback thing, we'd attract greater and greater spiritual blessings, make greater an effort, etc., etc., and we grow without limit to become refined, outstanding, highly developed spiritual beings. That hasn't occurred, it may have in your case, but not mine. That hasn't occurred, so we say there's something wrong. There's some missing factor. There's something that hasn't been put into this picture which makes it more realistic. And that's exactly right. This picture of the feedback relationship between effort and spiritual powers reinforcing has a big flaw in it. And that flaw is the existence of tests. Tests, if you will, mess it all up. The Guardian says we should not, however, forget that essential characteristic of the world is hardship and tribulation, and by overcoming them we achieve our moral and spiritual development. Baha'u'llah in the Hidden Word says, if adversity befall thee not in my path, how can thou walk in the ways of them that are content with my pleasure? And there are many other passages which go along with it. One more I can read from the Guardian. He says, we must always look ahead and seek to accomplish in the future what we may have failed to do in the past. Failures, tests and trials, if we use them correctly, can become the means of purifying our spirits, strengthening our characters, enabling us to rise to the greater heights of service. If we add tests and challenges to us, that now we have an adequate model. And the model then is of the individual who makes an effort, is subject to tests in the process, and by striving to overcome those tests, by persevering and dealing with the obstacle to effort, attract spiritual powers which make them stronger, and then they then make an even greater effort which often attracts even greater tests which they strive to overcome, and they go on. So the process is basically correct, provided that you add tests to it as an integral part of the cycle. Efforts, tests, and then spiritual rewards leading to the cycle repeating itself. As we all know, these tests are very insidious. We as Baha'is, and it's a whole other subject we haven't discussed at all, we do not believe in an independent force of evil. We differ from a lot of religions around the place that believe in the existence of a devil or Satan or Iblis or some such thing. Our writings do not tell us that we do not believe in an independent force of evil. But the term Satan is used in the Baha'i writings to symbolize the operation of the material nature of the human being. With that preamble, I want to draw your attention to a statement of Abdu'l-Bahá about tests, in which he says Satan appears to you in the dress you find most attractive. It's a pity. I didn't make up the world. God made it. Well, don't blame me. Tests appear in a manner, in a form, which you find most attractive. If you are a person who has grown up with a less than good relationship with your parents, you may find yourself tested by the fact that the Baha'i teachings call for parental approval or permission before you get married. And you become really hot and bothered over the subject, I'm big and strong, I'm whatever age I am, why should I go to my parents like a child and say, please, can I marry this particular person? Satan appears to you in the guise you find most attractive. If you come from a background where you've experienced sexual discrimination or oppression because you're a female, you come to the Baha'i faith and you enter this wonderful religion of freedom and emancipation, and bless my heart, you find in the middle of it is a universal house of justice, the membership of which is confined to male. And then you become very hot and bothered that you think a modern religion like this wouldn't be saddled with something like that, that it is. Satan appears to you in the guise you find most attractive. You may have come to the faith from having broken away from a religion which had a concept of an infallible head. And then as time goes on, you became clear to you that this was not accurate, that the so-called infallible head was fallible. You broke away from it. You looked for another religious belief. You became a Baha'i, wonderful thing, democratic and all the rest of it. Lo and behold, eventually somebody broke the news to you that we regard the head of the universe, of the body, the universal justice, as infallible. And your heart sinks and you say, I thought I was coming into something that was 21st century, and here it is, it has this 16th century concept buried in the middle of it of the infallible body. So, many, many ways, Satan appears to us in the guise we find most attractive. And in that sense, this cycle that I'm talking about of applying the magnetic principle involving effort, tests, and then spiritual rewards, the tests are not to be trivialized. They're not to be ignored. They are difficult. Otherwise, they wouldn't be tests. And what's tests to one person is not to another person. Distractions, procrastination, rationalizing to avoid having to take action. Peer pressure, fear of ridicule. For example, if you're observing the fast and everyone around you is eating like a hog, and here you are not eating anything and subject to ridicule over why aren't you eating? Why don't you just take a drink? Why don't you just have one sandwich or something like that? The materialistic outlook is a test. The frustration at apparent lack of result. You might say, I've been practicing the Baha'i teachings for so long, doesn't seem to have made any difference to me, doesn't seem to have had any effect. Why should I keep doing it? It's a bit like the child that says, why should I keep cleaning my teeth every day? Doesn't seem to have made any difference. They're still the same. Sometimes a test to us in religious practice is resentment of the required discipline that the religion imposes. This usually occurs during the month of March around 4:15 a.m. And 4:15 a.m. in the month of March, the bed is lovely and warm, the pillow is nice and soft, you're buried in some wonderful blankets, and the thought of having to get up and find something to eat and to force it down your throat at sunrise is not something that's at all attractive. You can easily become very resentful. So as many other such tests. Nevertheless, that picture that spiritual development presents to us is this complex picture of effort, tests, overcoming the tests, and achieving spiritual rewards. I now want to read to you a passage from the writings of the Guardian, which puts all this stuff together. And I will read it twice. The first time I'll read it, I'll do it at normal speed, and many of you will find it almost incomprehensible because it's a complex statement. Then I'll read it like a civilized person, much more slowly, and we'll pull it to bits and we'll see that it's pretty straightforward. The Guardian is speaking about hostility to the faith. He says, with every fresh outbreak of hostility to the faith, whether from within or from without, a corresponding measure of outpouring grace, sustaining its defenders and confounding its adversaries, has been providentially released, communicating a fresh impulse to the onward march of the faith. While this impetus, in its turn, would through its manifestations provoke fresh hostility in quarters heretofore unaware of its challenging implications. This increasing hostility being accompanied by a still more arresting revelation of divine power and a more abundant effusion of celestial grace, which by enabling the upholders of that faith to register still more brilliant victories, would thereby generate issues of a still more vital import and raise up still more formidable enemies against a cause that cannot but in the end resolve these issues and crush the resistance of those enemies through a still more glorious unfoldment of its inherent power. Basically challenge any of you to understand that when it's read out like this. What you have to do is to say, whoops, slow down, stop, let's look at this phrase by phrase and see what we make of it. And that's what I want to do now. The Guardian begins by saying that when the faith is subject to hostility, it gets an outpouring measure of outpouring grace, which can sustains its defenders. So far, so good. Okay. Faith subject to attack, it gets this outpouring grace and it overcomes its enemies. So what? Fine. Simple. He then goes on to say this outpouring grace, strengthening its defenders, communicates a fresh impulse to the growth of the faith. That's what you expect. Fine. The faith receives this outpouring grace because it's overcome its enemies. That strengthens it. It goes on even further in its onward march. The Guardian says this impetus, in its turn, provokes fresh hostility. Because now we're stronger. And so we arouse more enemies. And the Guardian says, this fresh hostility is accompanied by an even more arresting revelation of divine power. So this fresh hostility attracts even greater spiritual power to sustain us. That then enables us to register even more brilliant victories. And the Guardian says that then generates issues of still more vital import and raises up still more formidable enemies against the cause. And that then enables us to receive a greater measure of spiritual power and go on to even greater victories. What I hope is I'm conveying to you this cycle of effort, strengthening, making a tremendous effort to overcome tests, going on to receiving the blessings of spiritual power, which strengthen us, enable us to achieve great victories and to go on from there. It is a cycle. Is that, am I explaining this in a halfway intelligent way, that that the guardian is speaking of the things we have said that have these three components to them? Effort, the response to hostility, being blessed with spiritual power that makes the faith even stronger, raises up new enemies. We make an effort to overcome them. We receive an even greater measure of spiritual power, go to even greater strength. It's a wonderful thing. You can analyze the history of the growth of the Baha'i faith along this model. The Guardian then goes on to say the resistless march of the faith of Baha'u'llah resolves itself into a series of rhythmic pulsations. And we can see that in what he's described. The thing is a cyclic thing. They get the spiritual power, makes us stronger. That then enables us to do wonderful things, raise up new enemies. The whole mess repeats itself and as it goes on. So the Guardian says the growth of the faith is rhythmic pulsations as you go through each cycle. And I think that's why he describes it in those terms. He uses all sorts of other things he adds to it, but he refers to the faith as going through what he says as a series of rhythmic pulsations, which he says are precipitated on the one hand by the explosive outbursts of its foes, and on the other hand by vibrations of divine power. You might say, well, where does it all end? It all ends with the vanquishing of its enemies and the triumph of the cause. So we can raise even greater hostility, even greater opposition, draw upon even greater spiritual powers, overcome them, and ultimately the triumph of the cause occurs. It doesn't go on from now till the end of the cycle of fulfillment. It goes on until the faith triumphs. So it's a complicated picture. I spent this time on it because my personal view, and only my personal view, is that the same model applies to the individual. You make the effort, you confronted with hostility, which may be internal hostility. Why do I need to get out of bed at 4:15 in the morning? Something like that. You make a supreme effort and overcome it, attract spiritual powers, grow on to victories, and so on. It seems to me that the spiritual growth of the individual is one that occurs not just evenly, but in fits and starts or rhythmic pulsations. We don't grow in a rhythmic, even kind of way. Seems to me my own experience of myself and others is that we grow in a challenging way through fits and starts, through rhythmic pulsations. What does all this mean to? It means that if we hang in there, if we continue to make this effort, if we survive the challenges and tests and go on to attract a greater measure of spiritual power, we become spiritually developed. And I want to give you an example of spiritual development. And it occurs in the book Memorials of the Faithful, which is the account by Abdu'l-Bahá of various people that he was with in the Holy Land. And this account, I'll just summarize it. It's much better than the way I'm summarizing. It's worth reading for itself. It occurs, Abdu'l-Bahá describes how one day he's in Acre with the companions, and they're in Acre, and it looks like they were, yeah, they're on the roof of the caravansary, which presumably is kind of a mead in Acre, and it's getting towards sunset. And Abdu'l-Bahá is walking on the roof with his companions. And just about sunset, they see on the distant seashore that a carriage is approaching from Haifa. Now, there's the Bay of Acre, and you're on the caravansary. You can see way in the distance. In those days, there was no freeway. The carriages came along the edge of the beach from Haifa to Acre. Okay, it's sunset, and they see in the distance this tiny little dot, which is a carriage approaching, way off on the horizon. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "I observed a carriage was approaching. Gentlemen," I said, "I feel that a holy being is in that carriage." It's a weeny little dot way off on the horizon. It was still far away, hardly within sight. But somehow Abdu'l-Bahá feels that there's a holy being in that carriage on the horizon coming from Haifa. So he says to his companion, "Let's go down from the roof of the caravansary. The land gate is about to be closed. Let's go on and tell the guard at the land gate that we have somebody coming from Haifa, and please keep the land gate open until that person arrives. Go and tell the guard a carriage is coming. I think it's bringing one of our friends." They come down off the caravansary and they go off to the land gate. By that time the sun has set. The main gate, the big gate, has been closed, but there's a little space. If you go to Acre, you'll see that the big gate has a little space that individuals can get through. It's still open. So they find the guard and they tell him that there's one of their companions is coming. They don't know who it is. "And please leave that open." The guard is very cooperative. He says he'll do that. He even brings a chair so that Abdu'l-Bahá can sit down, and they wait. And they wait a while, and eventually the carriage arrives, and lo and behold, the individual who is in the carriage steps out and comes to greet them. And it is a man who's called the Great Afnan, Haji Mirza Muhammad Ali, a highly distinguished member of the Afnan family. And he is a very outstanding individual, and this man arrives and is greeted warmly by Abdu'l-Bahá. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "What a radiant face he had. He was nothing but light from head to foot. Just to look at that face made one happy. He was so confident, so assured, so rooted in his faith, his expression so joyous. He was truly a blessed being. He was a man who made progress day by day, who added every day to his certitude and faith, his luminous quality, his ardent love. He made extraordinary progress during the few days he spent in the most great prison." And Abdu'l-Bahá summarizes his story by saying, "The point is that when his carriage had come only part of the way from Haifa to Acre, one could already perceive his spirit and his light." And I offer this as an example of spiritual development to which we might all aspire, to reach that condition where even from a long distance away, those who are spiritually perceptive, such as Abdu'l-Bahá, could perceive that this was a spiritual being even when it was a dot on the horizon. And it is that that we're striving towards by the practice of this magnetic principle, observing the various things we've discussed today. Thank you. We have a little time left for any questions you might have before we go to get coffee or tea or whatever it is we're going to have. Yes, Ian?
even in the Islamic tradition, practice effort. Would they be receiving the same kind of blessings as this dispensation?
It's a very interesting question, concerning the fact that in other religions, such as Christianity, there is an effort is practiced. Would that attract the same blessings? Let me make a point before I get directly to the question, and that is that when I read the Baha'i writings about the emphasis on effort, and I go back and read other religious scriptures, such as the statements of Christ in the New Testament and even the Quran, they seem to be saying the same kind of thing. So it isn't as if the Baha'i faith has suddenly discovered something brand new that's not in other religions. It's rather that the Baha'i faith is putting fresh emphasis on something that's a deep religious truth, which is part of the nature of creation. So in that sense, it seems to me that a true Christian studying closely the words of Christ in the New Testament would come to similar conclusions, presumably if he or she allowed himself to be detached from Orthodox Christian theology. And that, of course, is up to the individual. In that sense, I think what I've talked about this morning about effort is a basic spiritual truth rooted in the nature of human beings in relation to God. And so it applies to all human beings, no matter whether they're religious, non-religious, or what religion or whatever. It's just been clarified by Baha'u'llah rather than something brand new that never existed before. And in that sense, it would be applicable to all people. Yep.
I'm just wondering, is when it comes to creation and things, is everything already been created, or is God constantly creating new things in different worlds, and or was it, has it all already existed? Has it already, like, in existence from the moment he created everything? Or is there things, you know, like science is still discovering things, and is God creating like a new something, like a new fish in the sea or some new life on another planet, or is he just sitting back watching us do our thing? Or that's
I didn't get it. Can somebody say it again for me?
Oh, sorry. I was wondering if God is still creating things.
Yeah.
Are these new life forms and...
Okay.
Yeah. In
other parts of the universe.
Yeah, or even on our planet.
Okay. For a start, it seems that any attempt on our part to try and say what God is doing and not doing is probably a little presumptuous, one way or t'other. Secondly, we have the fact that God is beyond the dimensions of space and time, and that's implicit in dimensions of space and time are implicit in any statements about the actions of God. So all of that complicates the matter. We can certainly see in the world in which we live, all kinds of new things are appearing in life forms. There are new life forms appearing quite commonly in the earth at the present time, and they are quite intriguing and giving us new insights into the nature of life and the nature of the vegetable and the animal spirit. For example, you find some of the studies that are going on around the Chernobyl nuclear reactor that blew up in Belarus or whatever some years ago. There's still intense radiation around there, but various plant life is emerging of a novel nature which can survive in the intense nuclear radiation of the Chernobyl environment. So new things are developing, finding all kinds of weird things in the rifts in the oceans around the, where the two plates come together and new forms are developing there. So creation continues to develop. As far as what's happening elsewhere in the universe, we only have the very brief statements of Abdu'l-Bahá and even briefer statements of Baha'u'lláh concerning the fact that life appears in all parts of the universe. Abdu'l-Bahá says in a book called Divine Philosophy that life appears in other parts of the universe in a form appropriate to the environment in which it is. So we have these fragmentary things, but certainly indicate that there is a lot going on in terms of the creation of new forms of life on Earth as well as in distant parts of the universe. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
My question has maybe a three-part, but it's around the same topic. So in regards to tests, first part is, are all tests, you know, obviously God tests us because he loves us, but are they all gifts? Are some tests just, can they be considered punishment? That's part A. Part B is it possible for not all tests to be from God? Is it possible that you're testing yourself? And then part C is, if you seem to be tested on the same things over and over and over again, and obviously, you know, you get, when you get pass the test, you get confirmations, you draw closer to God. If you're being tested on the same things over again and you only finally pass it on the 10th go, do you get 10 points? Do you go 10 times closer? If it's based on effort, is that the way it works or is it just 1 point?
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. Yeah. There's really a fairly comprehensive answer one can give to all of these questions, and that is that they all relate to the application of the justice of God, which is beyond our comprehension. For example, let's say, I know it's difficult for you to imagine, but let's say I were a nasty person. Oh, great, thanks. Thanks very much, folks. Okay, presumably there's somebody here who's prepared to say I'm not a nasty person. Let's say I was a nasty person and I go around beating up small kids and the like. You would say that's terrible. But on the other hand, maybe I'm a nasty person because I was brought up in a violent environment where that was the mores. And so you say, well, okay, he's doing this because that's how he was brought up. It's really his parents who are at fault. But why are they doing it? Because they were brought up in a certain other way. So you go on and on trying to find the root cause of the behavior. To what extent is my violent behavior attributable to my own free will? And to what extent is it due to the way I was brought up unconsciously regarding beating people up as normal? You see the point I'm making? We can't separate these things out, these things. We can't tell what the justice of God is and how it operates. All we can say that it sure operates beyond our capacity to comprehend. And that applies to things like the nature of tests. Clearly, there are some tests that you bring on for yourself. I mean, if you walk outside on the street and get hit by a bus, are you going to say that was the divine will, or it was just you were stupid and didn't look both ways? Things like that. If a test comes, say, 10 times, does that mean that you're just so obstinate and that you don't learn by experience, or that you do learn by experience? The question of rewards of tests is a whole nother issue. Again, it's one that is beyond simple comprehension. I remember some years ago reading the prayer, well, I guess it's Tablet of Ahmed, that says that if you say this prayer in an appropriate manner, you have the reward of 100 martyrs. And without questioning the wisdom of God, I thought this looked a little unfair. Here's this person sitting in a nice armchair and with music on and relaxed, and it's air-conditioned room and all that kind of stuff, and he or she is saying this prayer with absolute detachment and the like. That seems a whole lot easier than getting martyred 100 times. So I said to myself, why is it that the statement of the writings is that the reward of this person reading this prayer, absolute detachment, is equal to that of 100 martyrs. If I had to choose, this is what I choose rather than the 100 martyrs. It doesn't seem to fit together. And then when I thought about it some more, I thought that there is a poetic element to it. What is the reward of 100 martyrs compared to the reward of 94 martyrs or 96 martyrs or 17 martyrs or the like? We're talking about spiritual development and spiritual qualities that are non-quantifiable. And that Baha'u'llah's use of this phrase of the reward of 100 martyrs is a poetic way of expressing to us that the reward of seeing the tablet of Ahmed in a spirit of absolute detachment is massive, beyond comprehension, enormous. You can't even begin to dream of how great the reward is if you say this prayer in an appropriate manner. And he could have written, the reward is massive, dramatic and the like, and it wouldn't have had much effect. When you say 100 martyrs, it grabs you, it grabs your attention. It's a poetic way of expressing himself, because we're talking about things that are non-quantifiable. And I think that applies to this test that comes 10 times. You get 10 point or 1 point. It's what mathematicians call an improperly formulated question, because it requires a quantified answer and it's a non-quantifiable issue. But overall, anything to do with these issues of the justice of God, I think, are beyond our comprehension, beyond our ability to dissect them and to apportion elements of them. Yeah, there was some hand down here someplace. Yeah, okay.
Why isn't there a woman serving on the International House of Justice?
I thought somebody would ask a question. We're now time for the commercial break. Some years ago, this is a commercial break. Some years ago, Janet and I decided to write a book on the advancement of women. And we did this, and the thing is out the door. In formulating that book, we said to ourselves, such a book would be dishonest if it skirted around this major issue of the absence of women on the Universal House of Justice. And so we have written our thoughts on that subject in relation to the authentic teachings and tried to separate authentic teachings from non-authentic. And it's 15 pages or so on that subject. It's quite a massive part of chapter 4, and it goes into it in great detail. And I don't want to attempt to summarize an argument which we worked out very thoroughly and very carefully over a considerable length of time. And so the commercial break is to refer you to that book, chapter. Chapter 4 of that book refers to the question of the membership of the Universal House of Justice. It raises a number of issues concerning how does that relate to the equality of the sexes, to the principle of the equality of sexes, how does that provide suitable guarantees that women will not be suppressed in this dispensation as they have been in other dispensations and the like. All those issues are addressed. ultimately we get to the question as part of that section of the book on what is the reason. And the answer given by the Guardian and the Universal House of Justice is that the reason will become as clear as the midday sun in the future. This is most interesting. For a start, it is, as it says, the reason will become clear in the future, which means it's not clear now. But underlying it is the issue of how come, why is it they don't come clean? Why don't they finish with the whole business and say, this is the reason, finish? Why is it said in that way? We offer the speculation, and it is our speculation, that the reason, or the purpose of giving such an answer, the reason will come clear in the course of the midday sun in the future, is because we're asking the wrong question. The right question to be asked is, what is the difference between men and women? And we cannot yet answer that question. When we answer that question, the other question will become easy. For example, we say boys are aggressive and girls are peaceful and calm and the like. You give the girl the doll to be played with and you give the guy the gun. And so he becomes aggressive and she becomes peaceful and passive. So the wrong question is formulated and out of it come incorrect inferences. You find in the Baha'i community there is speculation about reason for not women on the House of Justice, and we say in our book very politely that we respect all these speculations but disagree with all of them. One speculation is that it's because women have kids and they're pregnant and you don't want a pregnant woman on the House of Justice. Well, we don't accept that. What's the problem with having a pregnant woman on the House of Justice? It can be managed very easily. We have pregnant women on national assemblies and local assemblies and the like. It doesn't create the end of the world. What's the big deal here? It's not the problem. If you want to get into a blazing fist fight, you can offer the reason that it's because women are emotional and tender-hearted than the men. And I hear this reason given from time to time and in speculation on this subject. One respects speculation, but certainly I would not agree with that in a million years. If poor dears are so emotional and this and that and the other, let's not put them on national assemblies. And let's not put them on local assemblies, or let's not make them as councillors or auxiliary board members. It just doesn't work. The socialisation process has created the emphasis on certain qualities and not on certain others, and a bunch of other speculations. So the various speculations current in society, we don't agree with them. We don't offer a counter-speculation, but rather we say that, as it says, it'll become clear as the course of time, as clear as the midday sun, and that we should focus on creating a society which reflects the equality of the sexes, so it will become clear what the difference is between men and women. We do not have a society at the moment which reflects the equality of the sexes. We have a wonderful Baha'i community of people committed to the practice of the equality of the sexes. But if you were to analyse any one of us in detail, I'm sure you would find unconscious prejudices, unconscious assumptions that we don't know anything about, which we're working on as part of emancipating ourselves from the pressures of the present society and creating a new society which reflects equality. It may be 500 years before we have a Baha'i community which adequately expresses the equality of the sexes, and then it'll become clear. But all those things are in the book. This is all a long commercial. Commercials always are too long. This is one of those, and certainly in that book we examined in detail. Got time for one more question, if we have one. If anyone wants, yes.
Yep.
In light of Baha'u'llah's exhortation to be anxiously concerned with the needs of the age you live in and center your deliberations on its exigencies and requirements, and the obvious failure of global political institutions to effectively deal with climate change, is it incumbent on the Baha'i institutions to lead the battle for environmental sustainability, or does the responsibility lie solely with the individual?
It seems to me that the question concerns climate change and the relationship between climate change and the political or social system in which we live. And certainly I think there is a definite relationship. From that comes the issue of what should we do. One possible strategy is for the individual or the institutions to focus on measures to combat climate change. Another possible strategy, which I favour, is rather to focus on changing the whole system. Because you can deal with climate change and lo and behold, you get zapped by nuclear proliferation or all kinds of other things. We have an existing social system in every part of the world which is inadequate to a multitude of human needs at the present time, of which climate change is one. And the world order of Baha'u'llah is our divinely ordained approach to changing the entire system, not by revolution, but by evolution, not by pulling the whole rotten mess down, but rather by creating new institutional practices which will ultimately replace the existing ones. So in that sense, what we call the Baha'i Administrative Order and the future world order of Baha'u'llah is far more than a pleasant way of occupying ourselves or of governing a Baha'i community or practicing equality and democracy and all kinds of other things. It is no less than the Baha'i beginning to replacing the entire governance system of every society on this planet, a consequence of which would be the resolution of a multitude of problems, of which climate change is one, obviously a very important one, but whether it's more important than some of the other problems is arguable. So it is by focusing on the world order that we effect a fundamental solution to this issue. Let's stop at this point. Thank you. Thank you.